And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I hope you had a good rest from electoral politics, because guess what? We're rounding the corner to the presidential campaign. Candidates and prospective candidates are beginning to make the rounds, and one of them is Chris Sununu, the maverick Republican governor of New Hampshire. We sat down this week to talk about his very interesting life journey as a second-generation politician and about this upcoming race and where he thinks a non-conforming Republican like himself would fit in. Governor Sununu, it's good to see you.
David, it is great to be seen. And I'm in New York. Where are you?
I should be in New York. I'm in Chicago. Long story. Don't want to burden my listeners with it, but you heard it as to why I'm not in New York. But hopefully we'll be in the same place again sometime soon. So listen, there's plenty to talk about, but before we get to all of that, I just want to get a sense more about your own story. Going way back when, because I've done 518 of these conversations, and I don't think I ever interviewed a Lebanese, Greek, Salvadoran on my podcast before. So tell me a little bit about that and your family.
Well, sure. So it's a combination. So my mom is full Irish, and my father is basically half Lebanese and half Greek. And the family emigrated over from the Middle East to El Salvador, a little bit to Costa Rica and Mexico. And my grandparents were married in Mexico. And people don't realize my father, as a lot of folks know, the former governor and White House chief of staff, he grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, right? You know, in Queens, right down the road here. I'm here in New York trying to sprinkle a little of the live free or die fairy dust into the People's Republic of New York today. But yeah, he grew up in Queens, and then he went to MIT. I was an MIT guy as well, and an engineer there, and met my mom, who was at BU. And then I think as he tells the story, he was living just outside of Boston, and they came up to New Hampshire, and he was like, oh, Massachusetts and these taxes, and didn't want to go back. So they just stopped, found a lot, and I grew up in Salem, New Hampshire. And I'm one of eight kids. I'm number seven.
I know. I wanted to ask you about that. I figure if you're one of eight kids, one of two things happen. Either you're very quiet or you're very noisy.
Both. Yeah, I was super shy. People don't realize I was that kid that wrapped himself around his mother's leg everywhere we went as kids. And being number seven of eight, like I wasn't the baby, so I didn't get the attention or anything, which was fine. but I don't know how and why exactly, but I broke through kind of the shyness and became a bit of a loudmouth extrovert, for lack of a better term. A charming one, though. I don't know.
We'll be the judge of that.
Yeah. No, and so I love people. I love being with people. I love their stories. And I love hearing what the heck is going on. And I was an engineer, right? I was a civil and mostly an environmental engineer. So I cleaned up hazardous waste sites across the country for a dozen years or so.
Yeah.
And then I went to more of the business side of things.
You ran a resort.
I did. I go from engineer to buying a ski resort. So I put an investment group together.
I think White Mountains Lotus, is that what it was called?
No, that would have been a good name, though.
Yeah, well, now, of course.
I'm not, but family's still involved, but as governor, I have to kind of, I ran that for 6 years. I put the group together, bought it. It was a storied four-season resort in New Hampshire. So ran that and did that for 6 years, and that ultimately got me to realize the live free or die state is very overregulated as a business owner. And my kids were starting to go to school, and I thought, well, these aren't the public schools that I grew up in. They're not terrible, good, really good schools in New Hampshire, but there was something a little different as a parent. So in New Hampshire, when you think things are different and you want to make a change, go make a change. Anybody can run for office in New Hampshire. And that's the beauty and the secret sauce.
Yeah, how big is your legislature?
400 members. 400. And how many Republicans and how many Democrats do you think we have?
You know, I should know the answer to this.
201 to 199.
Yeah, which says actually it really does speak to the politics of your state.
We're purple.
I want to talk about that in a minute, because I actually think that is really advantageous in some ways when it comes to actually learning how to govern. But before we get there, I wanted to talk. Your dad was a mechanical engineer. You pointed out he went to MIT, and he taught at Tufts for years.
Yeah, he was a professor or assistant dean of engineering at Tufts for a long time.
And he he served, I think, one term in the New Hampshire legislature with those other 399 people. And then he ran four times for different offices, and two times for the state Senate, one for the executive council in your state, and then I think one for the U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate, yeah. What a loser. Yeah. And he kept losing. What a loser.
Yes. So what did he, what is it about that, that where he didn't at some point say, maybe they don't like me. Maybe I shouldn't do this. I
mean, no, look, that's not New Hampshire. New Hampshire. Look, the unique aspect of New Hampshire is our system. We're not like any other state, whereas we have massive amounts of voter participation, whether it's on the school board or he was on the planning board for years. And when you have eight kids, my mom was on the school board because that's really the smart thing to do.
Probably for decades.
Yeah. And most of our taxes and most of our the influence you can have is all at a very localized level. That's why we're ranked as having the most efficient government in the country, because we keep things so local. So even if you lose a couple races, it's okay. You run again, and you don't need millions of dollars or anything like that. Look, you want to run for the House of Representatives, $50, go to Kinko's, make a bunch of photocopies, knock on a bunch of doors. Each representative represents about 3,500 people, right? So you can literally knock on every door four or five times over the course of election, look people in the eye, get to know them, tell them what you're about, and win. And that's what it takes to be part of a very effective public process. So it's not like, oh, I lost, I can't do it again, I need the power brokers to help. And that's not about that. It's about folks that just want to stand up and work hard and get elected. And he was a great governor. I was a kid at the time, but he was known as a three-term, really great governor.
Obviously, if he ran all those times, there must have been some discussion about politics in the House, right?
The battle was more about Yankees versus Red Sox, because he grew up in Queens and the rest of us were Red Sox fans, to be honest.
Hardcore debate right there.
Find me a New Hampshire family where politics isn't discussed constantly. It is in our blood. It's in our DNA. And it isn't, I'm right, you're wrong, we need to defeat them, blah, blah. You know, it's passionate, but it's all very civil because it's mostly local, right? The toughest political battles you will have in New Hampshire are literally with your neighbor over how at town meeting, over how we should fund schools and what should be done in schools and what's going on with the teachers' contract and whether we should have a trash pickup on Wednesday or Friday. That is where all these really, whether they're small and minor or very significant decisions, the majority of them are made at a local level. And that's just it. Voters shouldn't have the power. We say voters have the power. One day a year on election day. No. Voters need to have the power constantly and be reaffirmed and re-supported with their ability to design the best system that meets their community's needs. Do I agree with every decision every town makes? No. Do I agree with every decision every school board makes? Heck no. Could I ask the legislature to come down on them and change that and put my thumb on the scales? I could. But the most important aspect of leadership and power is knowing the limitations. And respecting that the best process is a localized one. The best one is that the voters know better than I do for their local decisions and issues. And you have to stay true to that. It's hard. It takes discipline.
You know, the picture you paint is a really wholesome one. Somehow, and I think the pandemic had something to do with it, there's been a real, it feels like, politicization of school board races around the country.
Oh, yeah.
And really with an ideological bent to it. Does that worry you?
A little bit. So I think, look, we've been having those fights in New Hampshire for 200 years, right? And we see it all the time. Now, when I see the rest of the country kind of engaging at that level, we've been doing it for quite a while. I think there's a little bit of a learning curve in terms of, you know, you fight hard, you fight passionately, but when you don't get what you want, it doesn't mean you ask somebody to blow the whole system up or you stop the whole process. You come back next year and you fight again, whether it's for a school board member you want or something going on in the classroom or the curriculum that you want to see. Parents in New Hampshire, you know, Glenn Youngkin very famously said, parents matter, and it turned his campaign around, and he did a great job. Glenn's a great governor in Virginia. But I joked to him. I said, yeah, boy, I love that another state is talking about parents matter, because we've been doing it for 200 years. So I'm optimistic in that there's a little learning curve there.
The issue really isn't, to me, so much that, of course, parents matter. The question is whether politicians should be mucking around in the politics of the schools, and whether they should become sort of the cauldron through which some of these big political issues and, you know, book bannings and the kinds of things that are inflaming our communities, right?
Yeah. And, yeah. Well, look, if, like, let's take it, a school board member, right? I guess technically they're a politician. They're running for office. So, yeah, the school board should have a lot of say in what's going on within the schools, and they have to be accountable to that. And if they're not doing a good job, you should fire them. And if the community decides not to fire them, then that's fine. That the community must agree that something's moving forward. I can't tell you the number of people who call me after a school board race and say, you know, we didn't win that race, so you should pass a law that does X, Y, and Z to basically step on top of whatever, you know, loss had just happened. It's like, no. Well, that's not the way we roll. I'm sorry you didn't get what you want. It's not what I would have wanted either. But you win some, you lose some. And if you have a good argument to make to your community and your neighbors, then go make it. And go fight that fight, and let's find better candidates or better arguments to make. But there are very liberal cities and towns in New Hampshire that I massively disagree with. Look, if the safety of a student is at bear, of course you got to step in and make sure students are safe and all that. But the state doesn't say, here's going to be all your curriculum guidelines. Here's exactly what you're going to teach in your classroom. Here's how teachers are going to manage day to day. We do not do that at the state level. The citizens have all the power. That's all the funding. Well, not all, but 2/3 of the funding comes from your local. The only taxes we really have are property taxes. And we do that because you have a direct say every year in how every dollar is spent, not the state. I don't decide how a single dollar of property tax is spent. I don't control your property taxes. You do. Now, we provide money on top of that in terms of education, and we provide guidelines. We've got a great board of education. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of the most important decisions are made at a local level. And that's kind of unique to a lot of folks. And but, you know, that's the way we've been doing it, and it's why we're so efficient.
I want to go backward for a second, because your dad got elected governor, and then he went to Washington. And he was the White House chief of staff. And you went too, right? You were in high school there for...
I was a TJ kid. Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Northern Virginia. I did my 4 years there. Yeah. We're stunk. I didn't like leaving New Hampshire, but, you know.
Well, the other element of it is your dad was a very public figure. And you know, the Washington area is really a very small town in its own way, very insular. The conversation is very much about what's going on in that town. And he was in the midst of a couple of controversies. One was he helped President Bush pass a economic program in 1990 that included some tax increases, and that created a huge backlash. Bush having promised not to raise taxes, I would argue, it probably laid some of the groundwork for the economic growth of the next decade. I remember I was on a plane with Lynn Martin, who was the Secretary of Labor at the time. And she said, you know, the sad thing is Bush probably laid the groundwork for a really good economic decade, and he's going to get punished for it.
Well, yeah, look, there was a massive recession, the banking crisis of 90 and 91, right. And there was a huge recession. He had done a great job with the war, obviously. I'm a huge George H.W. Bush fan.
Yeah,
I just, I such an admirer, such a statesman and a gentleman.
Yes, yeah.
And Barbara, I mean, just everything you want in leadership, whether you agree politically or not, it is what you want in leadership. And my dad was the outsider, right? He was the engineer, the MIT engineer, governor, kind of super smart. I mean, try bringing a B home on your report card to that guy, right? But crazy smart, photographic memory, but he was the outsider and never really clicked with Washington for a lot of obvious reasons, but was a loyal and passionate defender of the president. And I think he ran a very, very strong White House, as a lot of subsequent chief of staffs did. And yeah, it was just, for me, I was a teenager. Right? I was trying to deal with teenage stuff. Yeah.
He did get caught up in a deal where he was came under assault for his use of planes flying back to Boston.
Oh, yeah. He flew home for like a toothache or something or something like that. I mean, it's something that like is just happens literally every day now. But at the time, look, he and the press never got along. And so the press clearly had it out for him. There's no doubt about it. And when there was a little blood in the water, the sharks pounced. But
so how did that impact on you?
Not easy. I'm just a New Hampshire kid that was kind of thrown into the midst, and all of a sudden, the first few years were fine, and he had long nights, especially during the first Gulf War and all that. But as whether you want to call it the controversy or his name starts sparking up on the front page of the Washington Post, I went to a pretty nerdy high school.
Yeah.
Like everybody read the Washington Post in the hallways of my high school.
So there's no hiding.
No, there was no hiding at all, and that was really, really tough. And I mean, I never wanted to enter politics, not just because of that, but I never thought like that. I don't want to be in the sphere. I don't want to drag my family through it. And it wasn't until I was running my own business and then and my kids were going to public schools. I came up through public schools in New Hampshire. My kids were coming up through public schools. I said, this is a little different. I think we can make it better. And I had some executive leadership that I wanted to bring to bear. And that's ultimately why I ran for governor. And we've been great.
Your brother, your older brother, was a congressman.
Yes.
Was a senator. Was it always the notion that he was going to be the politician in the family? And
oh, no. Look, I think, well, look, it's New Hampshire, right? So my dad, my brother, and I, 3 of 10 of us entered politics, which is actually below average for New Hampshire. So it isn't like, oh, you're going to be the politician or whatever it is. Everybody in the family and in most families, and if I have a brother on the state, on his town budget committee, and another one's a selectman and this and mm-hmm. that. Look, one thing in New Hampshire we try to instill, regardless of your political party, you have to tithe your time. You have to give back in some way. Donate at your time at a food bank. Become a school teacher. Become a nurse. Give blood. Run for office. Find your thing and give back, because it ain't about you. And that's kind of my mother and father instilled a real sense of humbleness in all of us and said, look, you have to give. You can, you know, have your family and your business and do whatever you're going to do, but you always have to find a path to give back. And so that was just instilled in us one way or the other.
When you think back to your experience with your high school mm-hmm. when your dad was taking those hits and you were impacted by it, you have a family of your own.
Yeah.
Was that a consideration for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's so much worse now because of social media, right? There was no mm-hmm. social media. There was no even texting. There were no cell phones, for goodness sakes. Yeah. You know, everything was quite normal. So, understanding what you want to do in the public sphere and how it affects your family is absolutely critical. And but again, it's New Hampshire and it's a step we could take. And my family and my wife and kids have been very supportive. It's tough on them, especially during the pandemic. That was a whole different ballgame because all of a sudden government disappears completely except for 50 governors. And basically mm-hmm. 50 governors and the White House are running everything during the pandemic and having to make some tough decisions. Now, we navigated, I think, in New Hampshire very, very well. I'm blessed with a wonderful team. You know, we were ranked for number one in personal freedoms, but we're also one of the safest states in the country at the same time. So we were able to really walk, I think, a balance. And most importantly, I was out there every single day. And I realized early on, transparency is the foundation of public trust. And in a crisis, you need that public trust. And so being super transparent, answering every question every day, all the time, and being very accessible was the biggest asset we had to keeping the temperature down and not letting things get out of control like you saw in other states. But that all comes at the price of family because there was so much scrutiny on every little thing you did, and it did all 100% fall on my shoulders. I didn't have a legislature to lean on. They disappeared as did most, and even the federal the federal Congress disappeared mm-hmm. right after, I think, April. They decided not to do anything on the pandemic until December of that year, completely objecting their responsibilities. But be that as it may, tough on family and always a consideration in terms of what you do. They got to be with you or not.
On the pandemic, you did get very high marks for your handling of that. But you weren't exactly unscathed by it. You had crazies in your own state.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Look, I had protesters outside my house.
Didn't you have to shut down your inauguration?
Sort of, yeah. So my inauguration, I get elected in 20. We're just releasing the vaccines and all that. And I don't support mandates or anything, but we got the vaccines out really fast. We were very
You weren't an anti-vaxxer, that's for sure.
Oh, God, no. No. No, you should get, and by the way, you should all get your boosters. I mean, they do work, regardless of what people say. So, but we had, there were some threats. There were some people that were really, really fired up at the time. And, you know, we didn't want to do the inauguration inside at the time. So I said, no big deal. We'll do it outside. We'll do it on the State House lawn and, you know, we'll have everybody out there. Even if it's New Hampshire, it's cold. We know how to handle it. And ultimately, it wasn't a singular direct threat, but I think it was state police and enough folks saying, look, it's going to be really hard to secure this thing. Do we really have to do this? And I said, no, I'm not here to make problems and it's not fanfare for me, as much as to say thank you to the state. So,
and I think there was a group, I forget what they were called, who was particularly...
I got a couple names for them, David. You want me to...
Yes. I think I was talking about the ones they called themselves, not the ones you called
them. They're not free staters per se. Resolve, or I don't even know. It's one of these social media...
But they were menacing the the thing. So.
They were. And they were, look, they had been at my house protesting. It was clear they were going to protest. And look, you want to protest? That's fine. I have no problem if you want to come and protest in a public place like the State House. If you do it safely and responsibly and you make your voice heard and there's nothing threatening. Coming to my house is a different story. I don't live in a governor's mansion, David. I live in the same house for 20 years. I live on the cul-de-sac. I got the same cell number I've had for 20 years. Accessibility is one of the greatest tools that as a governor, I think you can provide your state as opposed to living in, you know, behind entourages and fences and all that. It comes with risk and it comes with a sacrifice to the family and everything. But there's always been an unwritten rule that if we provide accessibility as elected leaders in New Hampshire, you'll respect our privacy. Well, that was violated. And so it was a tough time for me and the family. It happened to coincide with the inauguration. So we said, we'll do a small event inside and we kept it there.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You talked earlier about being a purple state. Talk about the challenges and the opportunities, but particularly the challenges of governing in an era of polarization, the era of Trump. I mean, is it better to be in a purple state? Do you have...
If you know how to do it, it's an amazing opportunity. So let's look at what's happening federal. People say, well, it's such a closely divided house, they'll never get anything done. Look, I've had Republicans run my legislature. I've had Democrats run my legislature. And I literally have a House of Representatives that is pretty much dead even, depending on the attendance of any given day. We always get stuff done. I've gotten school choice done. I've gotten the most innovative voluntary paid family leave plan in America done, funding a full-day kindergarten, rebuilding our entire opioid system and mental health system, you know, bucking the national trends on some of those really negative dynamics. We're showing a model that we're able to do it all, regardless of who's there, because I'm more an executive. I'm very proud of our ability to negotiate. And sometimes I have to negotiate with my own party, sometimes with Democrats, sometimes with my own staff, frankly, in terms of where we want to go. And does it mean you can get everything you want all the time? No, of course not. That should never be an expectation. It means you give a little to get a lot. And I've been very good about being able to do that. I get along personally with pretty much everybody on the other side of the aisle. We disagree. We have some pretty vicious fights, both publicly and privately. But I do as well within the Republican Party. People know where I stand. I believe very strongly in individual freedoms and liberties. I'm very strong on the Second Amendment. I'm a fiscal hawk. I believe there's no greater responsibility than managing other people's money because you earned it, not me. You gave that sacrifice. You spent time away from your family, not me. But you've entrusted me to spend your time and your sacrifice responsibly. And so I focus very hard on super efficient government. And we've been able to do that. And when you do it with the right tone, and the right, hopefully with some positivity and hopefully inspiring folks and convincing them to come on to your side and what can I do to help you? And it isn't, you don't compromise your principles. You don't compromise what you're about, but you can always find ways where you can give a little to get what you really need done. And we've been very successful with it. So while people get annoyed that it's too close of a split house federally, I think good leadership can get that done. They really can. I think it starts from the White House, right? It starts from the executive position. I personally don't think Joe Biden's done a very good job of that at all.
He got a bunch of bipartisan stuff done last year, improbably.
He did. So this is the other thing I'll say. I think
You'll accept the infrastructure money, I assume.
Well, you say a bunch. I say four things, right? Yeah. So I think U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate have set the bar so low, set expectations so low, they get one or two things done a year, and we're giving them big pats on the back. It's like, come on, guys.
Well, these
get
were big.
They're big things.
They were big things. Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Bunch of presidents would have loved to have gotten that done. That CHIPS bill, bunch of presidents would have liked to get that done. A bipartisan gun bill. There were a series of things. But as it may.
But if I may, David, there's no immigration reform. There's no health care reform. There's no fiscal discipline. There's no balanced budget. All of these things that as Republicans in 17 and 18, we were promised. We had the whole thing. We didn't get it done. Democrats talk about we're not getting it done. So immigration reform is a big one. I mean, there's such an opportunity there. And most people, you can find a lot of
opportunity and a need.
and a need, a desperate need. It affects our workforce, our economy, our security, the opioid crisis. It all trickles down. But it has to start with a secure border and a good, appropriate legal immigration system so the best and the brightest of the world can be here. They want to be here. We need them here.
Yeah.
Right? But you got to have a system that has the right controls in place.
Now, look, I think that the idea of discouraging immigration and kind of throttling it down is an economic death wish for the country. We've always prospered from the renewal of generations of immigrants, your family, my family, first generation. So I feel strongly that way. But what about the people who are here, the dreamers to start with?
Yeah. Well, look, are you going to deport? Are you saying are we going to deport millions and millions of people? No, obviously that's not going to happen. But you have to have a process, a structure. You have to be able to clear out these backlogs. I mean, you're going to have people that are technically on a list to see a judge in 2027. That's just not practical, right? So I'm not going to lay out exactly what the plan is, but there's got to be a plan, and there is definitely enough Republicans and enough Democrats to say, look, we're not going to get everything we want, but can we all agree to secure the border? Yes. Can we all agree into creating a system and allowing our border agents to do what they do best and actually, you know, present that security and allow them to do their jobs? Absolutely. And then what's the legal immigration system we're going to have? It should be a simplified system, so it's not overly complex, but one that has accountability and control, so you're not letting just anybody, the cartel and all that. But the opioid crisis is the biggest issue, and I'm getting crushed by it. Yeah. Well, we were in New Hampshire. We're more middle of the pack now, but we were at the tip of the spear of this thing.
I remember.
Yeah, it was brutal. It was brutal.
I remember. You know, I do remember, and I guess it was 2013 when the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill, Republicans and Democrats, 68 votes in the Senate. They wouldn't take it up in the House.
Can you believe it? What a missed. Would we be having the same conversation about our border today? And I get it. They wanted to build the wall. I get no problem building a wall. I have no problem securing a border. Absolutely. But again, it has to come with these other controls. So they should have been negotiating harder. And I think with better leadership, whether it's out of the White House or leadership in the House and Senate, they could have gotten it done. But it seemed like everyone threw up their hands and said, everyone had a red line that could not be crossed. And they were all getting crossed. You don't throw up your hands and say, well, I guess it's not going to happen. We'll see in 4 years. No. You go back to the drawing table. You let emotions simmer down. Maybe you come back to it in another month. They did that with healthcare. Healthcare, the famous John McCain, right? He puts his thumb down on the healthcare bill. It loses by one vote on the Senate side. And all I hear is, well, I guess that's that. And I'm like, what are you talking about, man? In New Hampshire, if we miss something by a vote, we just bring everyone back into the room and we have the discussion again. We figure out how to revive this.
Well,
thing.
Isn't it kind of essential to have an alternative plan, like a real alternative plan?
Of course. Look, I'm an engineer. I love redesigning systems, and we did it on the opioid and fentanyl crisis. It's gotten wonderful results. We did it on mental health. But one thing I also know is you never design the system perfect the first time, so you need to design in flexibility so it can be adjusted, not 5 years down the road, but sometimes a year or two down the road. Hey, we tried these five things on our mental health initiative. These three worked. This one is getting different results than we thought, and this one over here is a disaster. Okay, great. So I can take that one that doesn't work, pivot the money and the funding somewhere else. I can have enough flexibility to adjust the rules maybe around that fourth one, and the other three we're going to double down on. So
isn't the problem sort of, Governor, that we have this screwed up incentive system where the instinct of a lot of people in politics is to weaponize problems instead of solve them?
Right. Look, If individuals, whether they're congressmen or senators, governors, whoever, presidents, you got to understand how the systems work. And I think they weaponize them when they don't understand how they fundamentally work. And because of that, they can't offer real solutions to the table. Therefore, it's, well, this piece of paper says we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Now, the system might be massively more complicated than that, but they don't know. They didn't take time to do the work. It's so frustrating. I think if everyone had to do homework, that it wouldn't be as weaponized.
Isn't it also the fact that for a lot of politicians, a lot of people, politics has been around it all my life, you know, job number one is getting reelected. And it's a little bit like our social media right now. You get rewarded for outrage and resentment.
I think they're missing the opportunity. Look.
I mean, I'm not endorsing that. I'm just diagnosing
it. I can count on the number. I maybe it's zero. I don't know. I don't get outrage. I don't try to, I don't show public resentment. I get frustrated, of course, but I always stay positive and I'm always willing to go back, and I'm so proud of the results I get, and you are rewarded. I am proof positive that you're rewarded for digging in deep and making decisions, even when people don't agree with me, right? I'm in a very purple state. How is it that I'm getting so much done? How is it that I won in 2020 by 30 points in the whole nine yards? I'm not here just to tout how popular I am, but I'm telling you the reason I'm popular is because I get stuff done and I treat people with respect, and I'm always positive and optimistic, and I'm always trying to promote in a not rainbows and unicorns and you know, fairy tale type stuff, but the real successes we've had. And I also own the problems. I have no problem saying, hey, I tried something and it didn't work. Right. Yeah. We did. I worked with police officers to do a justice reform bill. And it hasn't really worked. We were all on board with it, but it really hasn't worked. And I'm the first one to stand up and say, guys, I signed this thing and it ain't working. So we need to change the system. Let's own it. Let's engage the stakeholders, find the problems. And I'm telling you, that type of transparency, again, I go back to that, builds public trust, and and people want to look you in the eye. And the reason people get rewarded is gerrymandering. The biggest crisis in this country that really you can't put the genie back in the bottle is the fact that we have so many districts that are now gerrymandered, so few that are really up for grabs between Republicans and Democrats. So it forces on a gerrymandered Republican district, it forces that candidate to go further right. I'm not afraid of the Democrat. I'm afraid of someone primary.
Right, right.
Same with the left. And so therefore, our candidates are getting driven further into their extremes, and therefore they get rewarded by that, right? So I think that's more why they get rewarded, because of the gerrymandering thing.
New Hampshire in a purple state gives you the opportunity to operate the way you want to. What happens, because you've been pretty straightforward about at least looking at this presidential race, considering it. What happens when you move your show into the national arena and you have to navigate a Republican primary that operates a lot more like those gerrymandered districts than it does the state of New Hampshire?
I think traditionally it might have, but I do think that that's all up for grabs. I really do. And so if I were to decide to run, look, it was never really something I had thought of before. A lot of folks are talking about that's very flattering. They're more talking about, how are you guys doing it? Like, how is it you have no sales tax and no income tax and none of these taxes and all this efficiency in government and the most personal freedoms and the lowest poverty rate in the country and the strong. So how are you doing this? And so and you do it all in a purple state. You do it all with a completely divided house. Like, that should lock you up and you should be able to get nothing done. But we're very successful. So I love promoting that and talking about it. I don't want to use the word brash, but look, these are the ABCs of me. I don't really couch my words for anybody. Mm-hmm. After you've managed a pandemic, I'm like, look, you like it, you don't like it. I don't really care. This is just what's worked for us. And I'm also open for the feedback. So that has resonated with folks around the country in a pretty interesting and positive way. So I'm going to keep doing that. I talk to business groups. I talk to political groups. I went out to, good story, I went out a couple years ago now, I talked to the Republicans Party in California at their annual meeting, and it was right after they had lost the recall. And they were all down and depressed. We can't win. We can't win here. I said, of course Republicans can win in California, and they can, by the way. I said, but maybe you should start by, you know, not putting up the most loud, ultra-conservative Republican candidate in California. I mean, know your audience, people, right?
So on the subject, I think Mitch McConnell would have appeared in front of the state capitol there in a gold lamé tutu if you had agreed to run for the United States Senate. And I know everybody's going to have a hard time
probably
now getting that image
that
out of their
image
head.
That is burnt
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, yeah, right. A whole range of people urged you to run, felt that you had a best chance to defeat Maggie Hassan, the Democratic.
Yeah.
Senator, and you said no. Why?
Oh boy. Well, I was going to do it. I really was. I was a couple things. Former governors had run for the U.S. Senate, but remember, almost all of them were term limited. I wasn't term limited, so they weren't just asking me to run; they were asking me to quit what I love to do, and frankly, what I think I'm really good at, and that's being governor, and what I can not just defend the interests of New Hampshire against a lot of the progressive stuff coming out of Washington, but also promote the opportunities. I can just do so much. It's so much of a different job, and I love doing it. And again, I wanted to go to the Senate, not just to be a 51st vote, but to drive on things I think they've ignored, whether it's immigration reform or fiscal discipline and balanced budgets and all of that. But I didn't get a whole lot of sense that they were going to be on board. And I realized pretty quickly, look, in about 6 days, I'm going to be really frustrated with you. And then you're going to get really frustrated with me for the next 6 years because I'm not going to let up. And it wasn't the right step for me. And I talked to a lot of these Republican senators, and I've said it publicly. They were like, they're my friends, but they were like the worst used car salesmen in the world. They were saying all the wrong things. I had one senator tell me how much vacation I was going to have. I'm like, what's the matter with you? I'm the governor. I'm 24/7. I don't get vacation. And you're bragging about how much vacation you get? Do your freaking job, man. It really drove me nuts. I had one senator he'd tell me that, you know, balancing budgets, you know, American public doesn't really care about that. It's not important, Gov. It's not important. I said, are you a Republican or what? Are you a conservative? Do you care about the responsibility of managing other people's money and $30 trillion in debt? But they didn't. And so that kind of stuff was very frustrating. And I realized it was definitely not the right path for me. Could I have won? I definitely could have won. That's not the issue. But it really just wasn't the right path. And you see what's going on now. And you know, does anyone ever say, boy, I really regret not joining the circus? No, I don't regret it at all.
Yeah, what did you think about the spectacle last week in the house?
So here's my 2 cents there. That issue of those 20 individuals kind of holding things up, that was going to happen. It just normally happens behind closed doors, right? That actually happens all the time. But McCarthy's one mistake was thinking he had the votes and coming out and bringing it to a vote when he really didn't have those votes. So those debates and discussion happen with Democrats, and those debates and battles happen with Republicans, but we usually keep it in closed doors. It was transparent, and I love transparency. They did get something done that was constructive. They moved through their rules, very constructive. So it isn't like they gummed up the works permanently. It was a bit of a spectacle because I think there was a miscalculation on the early votes there. And it, you know, it's a little bit of airing of dirty laundry outside the house, but everyone has it.
It doesn't it also expose the fact, though, that because the margin was so small, that you do have a group that has more power than their numbers in that caucus?
Well, they think they do, and they've been given that in this process. But look, are you telling me McCarthy can't work on a bill? And let's go back to immigration reform. You can't say, look, we're going to work on this thing and we're going to get a lot of what we want. If you guys don't want to come along, I can find 40 Democrats who are just looking for these two or three pieces. Right?
That would be the smart play. That would be the right thing
to do. And he would be rewarded for doing it. America would stand up absolutely.
America might. The question is whether the Republican base would. You know, when you didn't run for the Senate, you got a candidate there, Don Baldick, and you
said
charmer of him when he was running, he's not a serious candidate. He's kind of a conspiracy theorist type of candidate. And you ended up having, you supported him.
In the general, yeah, look, I'm going to support him over. Look, I'd rather have someone I disagree with a little bit and on issues like that than look, Maggie is a nice person. I get along with her. We're very cordial. She lives on the other end of my neighborhood, for goodness sakes. But she just wasn't showing up for like 6 years, was not showing up. So I'd rather have someone I disagree with, but will actually show up for the job.
An election denier, a conspiracy theorist. You that would be more.
Hey, I tried everything I could to get the Republican over the line. That's
the other, you mean in the primary. You know, you remind me of a story, Jim Hightower, who was this populist Democrat agriculture commissioner in Texas, was in a debate with his opponent, and the opponent said, you'd vote for the devil himself if he was on the Democratic ticket. And Hightower said, yeah, but not in the primary.
That's it. There you go.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish. So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protest that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
I'm really intrigued with whether what you are offering is translatable. I mean, your position on abortion, for example, much more moderate than the position of the Republican Party.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one, if I could, because, look, for years, the example, say, let's say you have a pro-life governor, right? I'm pro-choice, but let's say you have a pro-life governor. And the pro-life governor would say, well, I can't ban it, of course, because the Supreme Court won't let me. So, you know, what are you going to do? Well, now you can. If you're really pro-life, you can ban it. And maybe that's what your state wants, right? Mississippi or Arkansas, one of those southern states. Maybe that's exactly what your constituents want. And that's fine. But and then you have kind of the more pro-abortion that are just, you know, a little bit all of everything all the time, which I'm very much against, where you can get an abortion up until the day of birth. And
yeah,
I did horribly disagree with that.
I think that's sort of a straw man. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But then you have the rest of us. Right. I have a 24-week ban. I have no problem with that because that's the third trimester. Some states might have 20 or 16 weeks, but they're all offering choice.
That's in Roe territory, 24 weeks.
Yeah. So look, if we get to the point where most of the candidates are just debating over the weeks, I mean, I don't want to speak for other governors.
But you have some states with really draconian bans.
Yeah. And then I think, yeah, I'm not there at all, of course. But and for those folks, while I disagree with that vehemently, if those governors want to stand up and say, yeah, we banned abortion, well, that's right. That's the pro-life candidate. And God bless him. He's going to stand on it. And that's his position. Great. We can debate it out. The rest of us are going to have some form of choice. You have 16 weeks. I have 24 weeks. We're still offering choice. So I just think the definitions are going to get a little bit gray. And I think it's going to be very tough for some of these governors, whether it's on a national stage or not, to start saying, well, I'm pro-life, but yeah, I'm not going to ban it. But it's your choice. It is now your decision to decide where you can go.
It's also going to be tough. You know, I think one of the things that happened in 2022 is you have very, very active pro-life, anti-choice organizations that demanded people sign pledges.
Yeah.
This was before the court threw out Roe.
Yeah, that didn't work so well.
And then Roe got thrown out, and all of a sudden you're stuck with this, and you saw people trying to move away from the pledges that they signed.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, you just got to be honest with people and transparent and own it and not overthink the politics. And I have a lot of people that might disagree with me on the 24 weeks or whatever it might, or maybe they're pro-life and they want me to be, you know, more pro-life and all that. I am what I am. And we can talk about and debate it. It's not the only issue out there. If you're a single issue voter on that issue, well, I guess you've made up your mind. So we'll move on. But there's so many other things, and especially in New Hampshire, so many other successes and good government, good management practices. At the end of the day, I believe in the individual. I might disagree with them, but I believe that they know best. I believe in the private business. Do I think government should be punishing private businesses? Hell no. I think wokeism is a cultural problem, very much so. But the government isn't here to solve a cultural crisis. That never works out.
Well,
you need the society to really take that on.
Because we're a podcast, not a TV show, I can't have subtitles saying to people, I think he may be referencing Governor DeSantis.
I'm sorry, who? No, look, Ron is a friend, and I think he's a very good governor. I do. I think he handled most recently the hurricane. He did a phenomenal job with that. But no, we have very different styles, very different approaches, and it's not about Ron. Obviously, there's a clear contrast there, but there are a lot of other Republicans and Democrats that I would call big government authoritarian that say, look, it's my way or the highway. If the locals don't do what we want, we'll just pass along, make them do it. No. You're now telling the voters.
Well, wait, would you just be clear? Yeah. Are you fitting him in this category? Because he did sort of, you know, he's thrown his weight around quite a bit in that state against corporations.
Yeah, I'll just disagree with some of the
local
moves
governments
made
that disagreed with him.
Yeah, I'll just say.
So is that big government authoritarian?
Yeah, in those instances, it was, sure. I just disagree. It doesn't mean he's not a good governor, but I would disagree. I'm sure I've done a lot of things that he disagrees with, and that's fine. You know, we work together. My wife doesn't agree with me on every issue, but the point is I do believe in the sanctity of a private business because I ran a private business. I sweat out other, you know, shareholder money and making sure my employees actually had a paycheck at the end of the day. And I would never want the government coming in and telling me how to run things or who I can hire and fire and all of that sort of thing. I do believe in the free market, right? If a private business is doing something that, as a governor, I fundamentally disagree with, I really believe the free market will take care of it. If people don't want to partake in that business and give them their business, they won't. And that business will shift. You're already seeing that, actually, if you, on a bigger scale, like look at BlackRock or Bank of America, right? Those are kind of, they kind of took these ESG woke policy type pushes. And a lot of people said, we're not doing that. We don't want to do business with you. And now they're kind of pivoting back. So we'll see where it all shakes out. But the point is this, the free market, let people decide. These are private businesses. I might not agree with them, but it's not the government's role to punish people or individuals they disagree with.
How much damage did Trump do to the Republican Party in 2022?
In 22. Oh, well, yeah, with what he did with January 6th affected 22, sure.
The
yeah.
candidate we were talking about, for example, Baldock, ran sort of with the imprimatur of Trump. Other candidates did around the country. The Trump candidates, particularly when they embraced the election denial, did poorly.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that affected. You know, the biggest problem that candidates had was Democrats were very, very good at predefining the candidates. And before they had a chance to introduce themselves. And so we had Republicans that might not have even all been all that extreme, but were defined as extreme. So as soon as they hit the general election, they're like, oh, no, you have it all wrong. And if you're doing that in politics, a place of defensiveness in your campaign, you're all screwed up. You're going to have a really hard time winning your race. So the Democrats were very good about influencing that.
So you're saying that these candidates checked the box to get through the primary.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They checked the box. They didn't understand. They didn't trust themselves to be good enough candidates without checking that box. And it can be done, especially in a place like New Hampshire, frankly. And they kind of missed the opportunity to be themselves. It's kind of weird that way. So hopefully we learn from that as a party. Hopefully Republicans said, look, none of it matters unless you win in November, right? You got to be able to close the deal. Hopefully we learn from that.
Well, isn't that the conundrum of the Republican Party, which is...
It was. I'm hoping it's no longer.
You've got certain imperatives that require you to move to... You know, like, talk about presidential races, okay? And this predated Trump. I think it's worse now with Trump, social media, and so on. But, you know, I ran two campaigns. John McCain was on the other side, the other Mitt Romney, both of whom turned out to be friends of mine, by the way, after those elections.
Sure.
And my perception of those races, both of them, was that those guys had to so contort themselves to try and satisfy the activist base of the party that they lost the most important thing that you have to have in a presidential race, which is authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
And I think you've seen that on a wider scale right now. A lot of it is the fealty that Trump demands, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly on the concept of authenticity. I'll tell you, I don't think it has been a prerequisite. I think it should be. I don't think Biden was very authentic. He would never engage with the press. He was the more moderate candidate, to be sure, in the Democrat Party, and then ultimately deemed and played as more moderate against versus Trump in 20. But if you're not answering in the press, you're not being transparent, you're not being authentic. And so I always had an issue. I think that's where, whether someone like myself or other candidates that just... these are the ABCs of me. I'm not trying to overly think it. And I'm not trying to convince you of something that you don't already believe. I'm just trying to open your eyes to the opportunities and the possibilities and the hope and the inspiration of bringing good conservative ideals of limited government and local control and low taxes. Those foundations are still a huge opportunity to drive on. I don't think you need to contort yourself. They do traditionally, but I don't think you need. I really don't think you need to. And I think it would be refreshing, even in the Republican Party and the Republican base, to find someone that isn't contorting themselves. You know who didn't contort themselves? Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And he was rewarded for it in 16. Like, that guy was who he was, and he let it fly.
No, I would argue, and I disagree with you on Biden, because I think whether or not he did press, I think he is who he is, and people kind of know who he is. And I think people knew who, you know, Obama was. They knew who George W. Bush was. And nobody ever said, gee, I wish Donald Trump would just speak his mind.
Yeah, right.
That's
exactly.
Never
no,
something.
Yeah, he didn't. He had the base, so he didn't have to, but he was never going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he played the character that he is, and people saw him as authentic. And yeah. Obviously that is something that you're hoping you can sell.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt. I think we can sell it, whether it's locally or nationally. I think people are dying for it. I think that's, people think with all the social media and all the political stunts and all of that and the lack of getting stuff done in Washington, they think it's just a bunch of BS. But I'm trying to let people know it's not. It doesn't have to be. Some folks make it about themselves, but I like to think that not just myself, but there's a lot of governors and other folks out there that do understand it's not about us, right? It's about a better system. And it's about inspiring folks to be part of a bigger team, tithing their time and being part of that process. And we may not agree. I may win some, I may lose some, but hopefully with what I bring to the table, I win a few more than not. But by God, I am going to get something done. I'm not dragging myself and my family through this public scrutiny and this public process, just for my own sake. I'm really doing it because we can move the dial. And in New Hampshire, we have. We're super, super proud of what we've done in the Live Free or Die state. We stay true to those ideals, and we can have our battles, but we never let it drag us down and stop the process.
I had Gretchen Whitmer on this podcast last week, who was making a similar argument about governors, basically, that governors have to get things done, and that experience would be really valuable for someone.
Yeah, we're 24/7, and every governor gets that for the most part. I mean, all 50 of us really do get that. If there's, God forbid, there's a shooting or a flood or a disaster or whatever it might be, our phones are literally always on. There's no vacation for a governor. I mean, even when we take a day off, we're not taking a day off because you can't get away from the phone and the whole nine yards of it. So it's a challenge. I don't have a lieutenant governor. I don't want a lieutenant governor, by the way. We're just fine without one. Less government is more. But the buck stops here. And I go back to being accessible and allowing constituents to kind of voice their concerns and complaints. Doesn't mean we may wave a magic wand because we're always on the clock and we have infinite power, but we can definitely open the doors of opportunity for those folks. And that's another key point. The government is not here to solve your problems. The government, that is not the role of government. The government is, my job is to create as many doors of opportunity for you or your family or your business, whatever. You're having a challenge with getting mental health services. I'm not going to tell you what service you have to get at what time and where and all. I'm going to create as many doors of opportunity so you do you. You find the right path. The opportunities of education. Look, New Hampshire has some of the best public schools in the country. Incredibly proud. But the four walls of that traditional classroom might not work for a couple percent of kids, especially low-income families who don't have a means for other options. So we have a school choice program that focuses on providing, you know, the state funds, however those families want to use those funds. I had families coming up to me going, no one's ever asked me what I thought my kid should have for education, but now I'm being offered that. I'm not telling you what path is best for you, but I'm saying if you need another path, here's the four or five other options that you might have. That's the role of government. And so I try to redesign my systems to be super flexible with as many doors, but I am really not here to tell you what door you have to walk through. You do you, man. Live free or die.
Yeah. Of course, when you walk out that door, you want to have a road to drive on, and there are certain things that government has to do that presumably you honor that role.
But we make sure all the roads are paved really well. So whatever one you want to take is going to be a smooth ride.
I know everybody would like, not everybody, many would like to get away from Trump. I can't let you get away from Trump. He's sitting there. He says he's running for president. He's still the front runner in most of the polls. Other polls say it's DeSantis.
He's the only guy running, though. I mean, he shouldn't surprise anyone. He's the front runner.
But don't you think he has a core base of 35-40% that are going to stay with him?
No, not 35 or 40%. No. He has a core base, I'm going to guess, of 20 right now, really. Look, he won the New Hampshire primary with like 35% of the vote, right? And that, so, you know, and it's only gone down. And he's only lost a lot of those independent voters and all that kind of stuff. So it's not getting any better. And when he announced that he was running for president, it was really at what you could argue his weakest political point. Right. So I don't think there's any undecided voter over former President Trump that's going to say, you know what? Yeah, I've been debating it back and forth, but he's my guy. Now, if you're not with him now, you're not going to be with him. And as more options are brought to the table and as those discussions happen, I just don't see him as leading the charge. Now, if you get 15 candidates in the race and they all divide up the vote, then yeah, could he win the nomination? Yes, he could. I don't think he will. And he definitely, I'm pretty convinced he absolutely could not win in November of 24. So let's learn from 22 as Republicans and say, we got to get behind a winner. And all that matters is winning in November and of 24. And let's find a candidate that we most align with and can win. But you have to have the and can win. And I think that's where the opportunity will come.
So So you think that Trump cannot win a general election?
That's correct.
Why?
Why do you think? Do you think he can win a general election?
Hey, whose podcast is this?
You're David Axelrod.
No, you're the
genius.
No, I don't think so, but I'm interested in your...
No, look, because it ain't getting any better. Because, by the way, because he didn't win last time? right? So he didn't win last time. He didn't get nearly enough done. As a Republican, I got frustrated. When he did something well, I was the first one to say regulatory reform was great. He was the fastest to get the vaccine out. People think he couldn't do it. He did the Abraham Accords. He did a lot of really great things. He tended to step on his own successes with some nonsense the next day. But he did do some successes, and I support him in 16, and I support him in 20. But we're just moving on. And I think most people have that mindset.
You said he did some nonsense that stepped on the things he did.
Yeah.
You wouldn't include January 6th as part of the nonsense.
Oh, no. Right? I'm talking about like while he was in office, right?
Shouldn't that be disqualifying? Like I'm running. What if you got stuck with him as a candidate the third time?
And I think that would be disqualifying for a lot of people, yeah. That's why he couldn't win in November.
And how about for you? Or does the Hightower rule still pertain?
I like the Hightower rule. I like going to that. Yeah, no, I would look. Whoever runs on that Republican stage, I'll support the nominee. I have no problem saying that because I do fundamentally think there's opportunity there. And if they were to win, I just don't think he can win. But he's not going to win. That's not going to happen. We're now playing in really extreme hypotheticals. I just don't think he's going to get there. I think he gets in the race. I think he gets out of the race. As soon as the polls don't look good for him, you think he's going away quietly? You think he's going to accept another loss? No way. He's going to start screaming that it's rigged, blah, 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 whatever it is. He's going to start firing at DeSantis and everybody else. And he's going to try to burn down the house before he leaves. But I see that could be a path. It'll be pretty interesting to see how it all plays out. But I see that really could be a path.
You're such a smart and reasonable person. Part of being smart is understanding that you can't say, I'm not going to support that guy if he gets nominated and then run, because you'd be disqualified by a lot of voters right away. But it's really hard for me to see how, given everything that's transpired and all of what happened leading up to January 6th, the impact of it, the devastating effect it had on the Republican Party, and forget about the country, going in 22. And I don't know how anyone says, hey, I'm going to give you, any reasonable person would say, I'm giving him the keys to the car.
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone wants to give him the keys. I don't think he's going to have the keys. It's just that, to your point, exactly. It's just not going to happen, you know. So, and again, we'll see who gets in the race. People say, well, too many people will get in the race. And as the kind of first in the nation primary in New Hampshire, I'm kind of the referee, if you will, whether I get in or not, whether you like it or not, you know, that's kind of my role a little bit. And I don't mind if a lot of people get in the race. What I will mind, well, I will insist on, and others will as well, is the discipline to get out. The discipline to say, this ain't happening for me. I'm only pulling at 5-7%. I'm not going anywhere. And I think a lot of these candidates who have effectively been running for like 2 years, and they're not going anywhere. They got to just kind of drop it and move on, whether it's today or 6 months from now. So it's not about who gets in, but I think a lot of us will be on the front lines to make sure everyone has the discipline and is, you know, even if it takes a little public shaming to drive folks out of the race. Scott Walker had this idea. You know, when he dropped out back in 16, he said, okay, a lot of you guys really need to drop out. The difference is, and I love Scott, he's great, but he didn't have the leverage. I'm heading up the first in the nation primary, and if I'm not running in the race, I'm going to have a lot of leverage, and I'm going to use it to clear fields that are just silly. And a lot of folks have, God bless them, they've been running for a long time, but they're still pulling at like 3%. It's like, okay.
I don't think, by the way, being the governor of the state with the first in the nation primary is necessarily all that helpful to you, because
if people say
you're the governor, well, it's a hometown win. And if you don't win it, they'll say, hey, he was the governor and he should have won it.
Yeah, it'd be the death nail of me. No, it's not necessarily an advantage at all, because it's really about the top 4 or 5 candidates that come out of New Hampshire in terms of the filtering that we like to do. So no, it's not necessarily an advantage at all. And I would tell all the candidates, whether I decide to run or not, go run in New Hampshire. You need to. You need to do well.
The Republican Party, being a bunch of social Darwinists, have this winner-take-all rule.
As opposed to superdelegates?
You get, well, no.
That's a brilliant rule.
But, I mean, you know, there's proportional delegate allotment in the Democratic primary. So you get 30%, you get 30% of the delegates, or roughly something like that. Do you think it should be more like that in the Republican primary? Should it be that you could get 25, 30% of a crowded primary and get all the delegates in a state?
Well, it's up to every state, right? The states dictate their
process.
Would
you encourage states to rethink that?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about that.
You should think about it, because it probably help you.
Yeah, well, I suppose it would, but no, I do believe in states' rights, and I think that I'm just going to be frank with all due respect. I think the Democrat primary process is a freaking joke, right? Like, think about this, right? So Joe Biden has said we're not going to have the Democrat primary, first in the nation primary in New Hampshire anymore. We're going to move it to South Carolina, where voter turnout was 16%, where a bunch of elite Democrats picked the winner. Do you know in 2020, David, there was no primary on the Republican side in South Carolina? There was no primary. They just said, Donald Trump, you're the winner. We're not even going to allow challengers. They're going to do the same thing for Biden. They're not even going to let the primary happen. They're just going to anoint him. So Biden has said, let's move the first in the nation primary from New Hampshire to a state that is not going to hold a primary. So now you have Iowa. And last time I checked in 2020, the Democrats completely flubbed Iowa. They're still counting.
Well, I think
it,
that's part of why. Yep. Well, yes, but I think it's one of the reasons why it's not the opening stanza. Yeah.
And now you have New Hampshire, which again, Biden says he's not going to play in. And we'll get to that in a second. Then you have South Carolina, which again, they're not even going to let the primary happen. Then you have Nevada. Nevada, I think they're still counting votes from 2 months ago. I don't even know who won over there. So the first states for the Democrats are going to be a mess. So what does it mean? A challenger is going to have an open door.
You got Michigan and Georgia.
Oh, Michigan and Georgia, fine. But when it comes to New Hampshire, we're holding ours first. I don't care what Joe Biden says.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Listen, we're running out of time, but I just want to ask, how are you going to make this decision, and when do you think you have to?
Look, I'm going to keep traveling the country and keep talking to folks, and we have a group called Live Free or Die, and we're raising some money to really get the message out about our record of success and what New Hampshire's all about. And I spend a lot of time with the younger generation Republicans or potential Republicans trying to— Democrats are great at influencing. We tend to advertise, and it's so wrong. Democrats, we got to get Republicans influencing that group to open ourselves up and make sure that they know that they can be part of an awesome team. And I take a lot of responsibility there. You know, I think all the candidates will have to start making hard decisions in the July, August timeframe. And so that there's still plenty of time for all that to play out. Politics will go up and down three times between now and then. And, you know, we'll see what happens. It's going to be a great ride on both sides. I think you're going to see a challenger for Biden. I think you're going to see 8+ candidates on the Republican side. And then, you know, we'll see how it all kind of winnows itself out. I mean, the debates will be a lot of fun. I got to tell you, I'd love to debate everybody. I love debates. I just have a ball on those things. If anything, I'll just make sure that the ratings are really, really good. We'll have some fun.
Yeah. Well, so the headline here is that you're going to run around talking to donors and explaining that living free and dying is expensive. And so they need to kick into the live free and die.
I wouldn't put it that way. I would say, hey, come to, you know, if you're from, like, you grew up in New York, is that right?
Yes.
And you're in Chicago now? Yeah. Dave, you come to New Hampshire for like 10 minutes, it'll feel like you got paroled.
Listen, man, I have to tell you, I covered, as a newspaper man, I covered the New Hampshire primary. I loved covering it, the New Hampshire primary. I loved the attentiveness that people showed to candidates. I had 15-year-old kids tell me they couldn't tell me who they would vote for if they could until they met all the candidates.
That's right.
So I think that people take their responsibility seriously.
Yeah. And I tell anybody that wants the first in the nation primary, come to New Hampshire, watch how we do it. And
not a very diverse state. That's one of the issues. But
well, when we have some of the highest voter turnout, we have the most. Yeah, I think we do have a diverse state. Oh, yeah. More diverse than South Carolina, where elitists pick the winner and almost nobody votes?
Well,
what's the point of diversity if people aren't engaged?
Yeah, I suspect the turnout will be higher, if not this election, if there's no competition. But, you know, when there's competition, we had plenty of people turn out, I think, when Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards were running in South Carolina.
It's still South Carolina. I'm not trying to pick on South Carolina, but it's always one of the lowest voter turnout states. If you can do it like New Hampshire does it, where it's not about the party bosses, it's not about the money or name ID, everyone's got an even shot, you know, come and show me. But until then, New Hampshire is, we are the first in the nation primary because we've earned it. And I challenge anyone to step up and try to match our metrics.
Well, I'll be there, Governor, when you go down to South Carolina and tell them that they ought to be more serious about voting.
Yeah, so, I would love it. I'd love, look, there's the opportunity. Get more people to vote. Really allow them the process to take place. Do you really think they should not have a primary in South Carolina when there's an incumbent? Do you think that's fair?
They're going to have a primary in South Carolina.
Because people are going to run in New Hampshire.
I think if Joe Biden runs, my guess is that there will be less of a challenge than you think to him. And, you know, obviously he's popular in that state.
But, you think so? You think they won't challenge him?
I do.
Oh, I disagree.
I've said that consistently.
Very interesting. You know what you know what the liberal elitists say about Joe Biden behind his back? Exactly what they said to his face, that he was an out of touch old white guy that didn't represent, that doesn't represent the future of the Progressive Party. I just can't imagine that they're going to let that stand. I maybe I'm wrong. I don't, it's your team, not mine,
but I just can't
imagine.
You probably hang around with more liberal elitists than I do. But hey, listen, I so appreciate being with you.
Oh, this has been great.
And I hope
Thank you, David.
This is the first of a lot of conversations that we'll be watching with interest.
Anytime. So wait, are you a Yankee fan? Or are you like
I grew
Cubs
up hating
fan.
The Yankees. I was a Mets fan until 1977 when they traded Tom Seaver to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And now I'm a Chicago fan, and I have season tickets on both sides of town.
Oh, that's
because
great.
Being from not from here, I don't have to make tribal choices.
There
so
you go.
I just like being in a town that has baseball every day. So
yeah,
I'm rooting
awesome.
For both those teams. So you come out, we'll go to a game.
I love it. I love it. Thank you for the time, buddy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.